In a book called Fighting for Your Marriage, the authors write, "The two of you didn't marry each other with the goal of having a great conflict management partner." And ha, that is presumably true, though possibly something that some of you should have considered a little bit more before you said, "I do." For whatever Disney has done to pamper our romantic imaginations, marriage in this post-Genesis 3 world tends to have, even in the best ones, still tends to have a lot of conflict. My session is about conflict resolution, and I am perhaps the world's leading expert about half of that. I am the leading expert, definitely, out of all of those who are teaching this session. I am conflict waiting to happen. I am conflict waiting for you as soon as you open the door. My middle name is conflict. There have been occasions in the past when ladies, church ladies, nice ladies, have been in a conversation with my wife and expressed their thoughts about how wonderful it must be to be married to someone like me. They have actually said things about how they can just imagine that Mo and I have the most delightful times together and the deepest theological and biblical conversations and an idyllic matrimony. And I suppose that to people who are just far enough away, it may actually seem like I am easygoing and or sympathetic, and ready to lead. And if that, in fact, happens to be your thoughts about me, he seems easygoing and nice. You're just wrong. I'm not. My wife has always done a supernatural job of respecting me and not letting on about how much she actually has to put up with. As I was saying, I know all about conflict. By God's grace, I am excited about the vision of conflict resolution that he has allowed me to see. Sometimes I see relational and familial and spousal peace and harmony as through a telescope. It is very clear and very far away, but it looks good. Other times, also by God's grace, he has humbled me and broken me and caused me to want something better than I had previously imagined. Mo, in particular, is a great gift to me, both when she challenges me and when she forgives me. I am thankful to the Lord for his gift to me of her. This coming summer, we will finish 20 years of marriage, 21 years of knowing each other. We have made and still do make quite a number of messes, so sorting out your mess is the title that goes along with some of the other titles as well. Yeah, I do think that finally we are making some less messes or less big messes and cleaning up the messes that we do make more quickly and better. Is that true to say? She gives me the Donald Trump, so. Sorting out marital messes is something that a lot of husbands and wives stink at. And it's actually something that a lot of Christian married couples sin at. And I'm not really a statistics-driven sort of guy. I am not spreadsheet nerd person in our relationship. But divorce is prevalent, and even more so than prevalent, it is more acceptable than maybe at any other time in our history, like our human history. Prevalent and acceptable, culturally acceptable. The unwillingness of spouses to sort out their conflict has grown some of the most miserable people in some of the least happy homes and gone into a very then immoral society who doesn't know what marriage is actually even for. The failure to resolve conflict in a godly way has no doubt been one of, if not the strongest ingredient in the collapse of the family, because our kids see us and they say to themselves, "Why would I want that? That's on us. That's our fault." I don't think that it is good for our kids to make those sort of conclusions purely based on their experience. But of course, that's a huge place where they're learning. It is in particular Christian couples who have given their kids no reason to want to get married. Why would I want to do that? Dating is not driven just by out-of-control hormones, but by needing to test drive different relationships to see how much garbage this person is really going to give me. Adult adolescence is not just a result of parents who are unwilling to train their kids in fruitful responsibility taking. Adult adolescence is a result of young people watching us appear to hate our responsibilities. We might not hate them, but we appear to them to hate our responsibilities and all the work that it is to talk. Who wants to talk? Dave said we have to talk about stuff. Talking is dumb. Even my wife, who loves to talk, like, I don't want to talk. I just talked here. I'm done talking. Our kids see us not resolve the problems and not try to work it out. So to them, it seems wise to avoid those responsibilities and commitments. Spouses who don't know how to get along become parents who don't know how to get along, who raise kids who don't know how to get along, and the cycle continues. Our marriages are a mess. Our families are oftentimes a mess, but not at a marriage seminar, so that's good. We can at least look good here for a little bit. We'll have the fight on the drive home or when we get home, but not while we're here. Give the eye so that they know it's coming. All for want of failing to take responsibility, and in particular, I'd say husbands failing to take responsibility to resolve conflict for Christ's sake. And this is not something that is solvable by marriage hacks, like life hacks. There are not marriage hacks. Like, you can hack your marriage, but not in the kind of life hack, productivity. Just do these three simple things and it'll fix it all. Or tips. Boy, do I hate the word tips. Do you have any tips for me on that? I don't care anymore. You asked about tips. I don't like that idea. For the record, a tip in the dictionary is a word to the wise, which means there needs to be some wisdom there already for the tip to be any good. You don't get a tip in order to make you wise. You have wisdom, and you're far enough down the road that you know you need a little extra piece to finish it up, not to start out with. You don't need a tip to get started. Likewise, a tip is a recommendation for those who are trying and working, not something to make it so you don't have to work. We're past the point of tips being able to fix our conflict and try to help us resolve it. If we have to talk about tips, we need to be talking about tips of icebergs, as in realizing that we are oftentimes dealing with a massive number of issues that are under the surface. So I'm going to keep using the word tips, just to spite the word tips, but I'm going to stress the idea of tips as it relates to a whole bunch of other things that go along with it, not just something that you can easily put into practice and make it all better. Some of us are relationally retarded. We all sin, and the other men have said that, but some of us sin in especially aggravating ways. And then what's worse is we act okay with the distance and the isolation that we've created by our aggravating sin. I know of precious few couples who can say that they had great examples to watch in their own houses growing up. Add to that, we have established patterns in our speech and behavior and tolerated sin in such a way that we need help. So the tandem bicycle of our marriage relationship is upright, but it is only upright because the wheels are buried in the mud and we're yelling at each other about why we're not going anywhere. It's our fault, and potentially we're going to need some big shovels to dig the wheels out. So even though we know a lot, including a lot about what God's word says about how we're supposed to treat one another, most of what we need to do is obey. I know this from lack of obedience, not from counseling situations. I know from my own failure to obey that my problem is not that I don't know what I need to do, it's that I don't obey what I know I need to do. And this is part of the reason why there aren't tips, there aren't hacks. There is no bullet point list of things that is going to resolve all of our marital conflicts. So we need to obey. Now that said, because it's a session, we could take the rest of the session and I could just say, obey. I could like look at each person in the eyes. Obey. 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 We could just, and maybe we could go through a couple cycles of that and then you'd get through the repetition that that's what we need to do. But it's a session and it's my turn to talk in the relationship that we have here. So I'm talking. And I do think that talking could help us with some issues such as shared language. For example, I really enjoyed listening to Dave Ramsey's Financial Peace University because I am the kind of person when it comes to money that has previously wished I didn't have to deal with it. I married her so she could take care of it. I married her so that she could raise the kids and educate the kids so that I could like think important theological thoughts. It's what I needed to do, and she was going to take care of all the rest of them. And it seemed like Sarah Edwards did that for Jonathan Edwards. So there was my Sarah. When I started to realize that I was supposed to be responsible for the money too, and listening to Dave Ramsey's Financial Peace University, it wasn't even necessarily that we have to do all of those things, but then we could share some common terminology about it. And when it comes to conflict, being able to have some shared language is a beneficial thing. Likewise, perhaps you're needing an imaginative diagnosis with imaginative treatment, and I don't mean that in terms of you need a fictional diagnosis or a fictional sort of treatment. I mean you need to get out of the rut that your thinking is in and realize maybe there is something different. Maybe it doesn't have to be like this anymore. And then teaching can provide renewed hope that, you know, the reminders that in Christ, conflict can be resolved and the mess can be sorted out because Christ is not in the grave. So he rose again on the third day and sin is paid for. By the blood of the cross, he's made peace. So we need to be reminded of that sort of hope and that we can then enjoy the joyful intimacy that the triune maker gave for us to know and have. So I'm going to come back to this in a little bit, but as I brainstormed for this session over the last couple months and tried to be less conflict creating, because I was going to have to talk about it, the worst, she's going to hear what I'm saying. I believe that the greatest source of our conflict is what we want. I think that the problem is that our wants are wrong. And the only way we're actually going to clean up conflict is to get some better wants, desires. As Rosie O'Donnell's character told Meg Ryan's character in Sleepless in Seattle, you don't want to be in love. You want to be in love in a movie. Or wives, you want to be treated like a princess in a Disney musical after the beast comes back to be the human-looking person. Or husbands, you want to be pampered when you want and then be left alone when you want. Or you want to be seduced by a two-dimensional woman on a screen who only takes your time and potentially your money but doesn't ask for anything else. That seems easier. Maybe those are extremes, both on the guy's and the gal's part. But, I don't know, do you want to serve more or do you want to be served more? On the scale, do you want to serve or do you want to be served? Which is your greatest desire? Do you want to be connected or do you want to just have gotten married because your parents told you, because they were Christians at least, that the only place that it was biblical to have sex was within the fence of marriage. So you had to get married and deal with the other things just so that you could be a biblical, right Christian in where you had your marriage bed. Now you realize that's more work than you bargained for. What we ought to want is intimacy. What we ought to want is joyful, Trinitarian sort of relationship. What we ought to want is peace. What we ought to want is love. And I want to argue what we ought to want more than anything else is God's blessing. When you think about what you want in your marriage, part of the problem is why we have so many conflicts is because we don't want the right things. And I wonder if we thought about it in terms of wanting God's blessing, if that would change how we interacted with one another. So I said I'm going to talk about tips. So I'm going to talk about conflict tips, and I'm going to talk about resolution tips. But again, in my mind, I'm connecting it more to the iceberg tip and underneath. So let's talk about some conflict things above the surface. Conflict is, according to Merriam-Webster, competitive or opposing action of incompatibles, antagonistic state or action as of ideas, interests, or persons. There's opposing actions or ideas or wants. That's where conflict comes from. According to the Apostle James, he would describe it as passions that are at war within us. They are selfish desires that get taken out on those around us, and typically our spouse is the closest one. They're in the immediate line of fire. When it comes to, then, conflict above the surface, marriage books and divorce courts report the data for the kinds of things that cause conflict. The lists always include things such as money, children and parenting and their education, sex and in-laws and free time, entertainment standards, household work, chores, responsibilities, and pursuit of careers. But these are clearly just representative. They're some of the biggies. We know that the list could also include disagreements about over where the dish towel should be hung and how socks should be folded and which direction the toilet paper should come off of the roll. And clearly that is over the top. There is no reason for the underneath of the toilet paper. Even for short people, there's no reason for that. Conflict can come from not understanding and then not trying to maximize the different personalities that you have or the different experiences that you come with, internal and external processors. Like, I don't talk until I have my answer. Mo doesn't have her answer until she talks. And for a long time, I refused to consider that possibility. I required in my own mind, but I didn't tell her this because I was still trying to finalize it. I couldn't take, like, why are you making your decision 20 times? Well, because she was coming to her decision by talking about it. Now, in the church, symptoms could also include unclear or immature leadership as well as weak or inconsistent submission. So Christian wives have special spiritual sounding complaints against their husbands because of the Bible. I read what he was supposed to do and he's not doing it. And likewise, Christian husbands have special spiritual sounding complaints against their wives because of the Bible. I've got verses. I don't have a verse about the toilet paper thing, but I've got verses about how you're supposed to be behaving and you're not behaving like that. You're not meeting God's standards. This is a problem. I desire that you obey what God says. Well, and that's an okay desire, except for when I desire her to obey and I don't have to. Or I think I'm desiring her obedience to the Bible while refusing to obey myself. So we've got Bible verses for our expectations about how the other person is supposed to act, albeit ignoring the verses that say to not fight. So we're selective in our verse plucking and who needs to obey what. But of course, I say that these are all above the surface. And like that first set of things, those are big categories, and yet, like, receiving a $10,000 check in the mail cannot make you sin, nor can a $10,000 unexpected bill. Money or lack of money cannot make you fight. Your in-laws gave you your spouse. So whatever else, and how did they do that? It was by sex, right, Dad? I did tell Mo that she's the only person in the room who is the fruit of the sex of the person who was talking at that time. So it doesn't matter what dumb sauce my mother-in-law puts on meat when she's making dinner. I got Mo, right? I always have a reason to be thankful for my in-laws, no matter what. Jesus said there is nothing outside a man that defiles him. According to Mark chapter 7, verses 14 through 23, sin comes from within. So these, as significant as they are still surface issues. They're more like stain on wood. They can show more of what the grain is like, but they're not actually affecting what the grain is. How about conflict below the surface? There are a variety of things. And I am sure that my list is going to be partial. Hopefully it is helpful, but I'm sure there's lots of things that I don't even get that could be below the surface that cause conflict. But here are some. A guilty conscience. If you have some other sin, whether it is a secret sin that you're desperate to hide or an obvious sin that you just refuse to confess as sin, oftentimes you're going to try to cover your sin by attacking the other person. That's classic misdirection. I'm on fire. Look at your smoke. Something must be wrong with you. I am sure of it. Do whatever it takes to make the other person the bad guy. So, like, guys, if you're watching porn, or if the bookkeeper is hiding financial problems, or if you're sneaking around, you're not connected. You're going to deal with your problems from a platform of not being connected. And there a fight happens. That is a surprise. Sins are systemic. You cannot compartmentalize one sin away from your relationship in the marriage bond. Your sins are going to do damage whether they're plain to see for the other person or not. Out of control emotions. If you lack peace, if you feel insecure, you will potentially try to tear down or sabotage the strong one. Because if you can't feel okay, ain't nobody going to feel okay around here. It could be funny. It's funny now. If you don't feel okay, why doesn't your husband empathize with you and join you in your pain? Your spouse may actually be a clown, but even clowns have the sense to run away from a raging bull at the rodeo. They may look silly, they may have big doofy makeup on, but they know enough to get away from the person who's out of control and coming at them with the horns and the snorts. Uncommunicated and or unfilled expectations. And at this point, it really doesn't matter where your expectations came from. Like, you can think about that and talk about them. Your expectations could come from how you grew up, from what you've watched, from a previous relationship. You may not even be aware of your expectations, you are aware of your expectations, but you haven't communicated your expectations, or you are aware of your expectations and you've communicated your expectations, and your expectations are crazy. They are unreasonable. But these expectations that we have are running in the background program of your brain, whether or not the app is filling the screen. It's like a virus. So you have expectations about sexual frequency and sexual taboos, about romance, what qualifies as romance. I came home. Not enough. About children, how many children, how to discipline children, how to educate children, about whether and what sports they should play and how they're going to get to those sports and who is taking them places, about degree of emotional dependency, about who is working and who's not working, about who's cleaning, cooking, shopping, and doing the laundry, about how much time you're supposed to spend together, and how much time you can spend with other people, and how to deal with problems, and how much you have to talk about dealing with problems, what forgiveness looks like, how quickly it is granted, about toilet seat position, about who writes thank you notes, etc., and ad nauseum. You have expectations about all of these kinds of things. Each person does. And sometimes we talk about them, and sometimes, again, they're running in the background, and we're mad that the other person hasn't met our expectations. We never even told them that that's what we hoped that they would do, let alone demanding that they would do, but we're punishing them because they're not fulfilling our needs, so we think. When was the last time you proactively, like before the pressure was on, when was the last time you talked about your expectations with your spouse? Doctrine idolatry or Pharisaism. This is especially applicable to people who love the Bible, ironically. It's to the truth people. If the only spoke in your worldview wheel is the catechesis, the theology, the doctrine, then you will, without doubt, need to be right more than you need anything else. Maybe nobody else in here has had this problem. I know at least one person has. I was so committed to the truth and theology that I was a jerk, but supposed to be right. But what was I right about? At best, I was right about sentences, not right about how to treat another person. If God is the big theology Bible test proctor in the sky, then what we must fight for more than anything else are correct answers. If, on the other hand, things such as lifestyle and narrative are important, then we'll need to do more than just be right. But if you start to get the whiff that your spouse is a heretic because they're not convinced what head coverings means, potentially you've got this problem and it's causing conflict in other areas because you're like the police of their theology. Bitterly unloved or angrily disrespected perceptions. These could go along with the expectations part, but generally speaking, women want to be cherished. Guys want to be respected. If you think that your spouse isn't seeing you, and as Christians, if you think that your spouse isn't obeying Ephesians 5 and Colossians 3, then that's going to filter how you hear almost everything that they say. And you'll start to interpret their comments and their conduct negatively, which does actually mean, according to one of the definitions of what love is, about believing all things. You're not believing the best. You're attributing bad motives to what they're doing. So you can't hear any or see any of the good things even that they say or do. You assume that they're trying to play you. They're showing off some other way to misdirect. Last one I'm going to mention is engaged in no other conflict. I think that this is directed at the guys especially, since guys are made to, one of their responsibilities at least, is to fight. And if guys will not fight the world and unbelief, we will find enemies at home. We have this I must conquer sort of mindset. And fighting at home is the perfect way to fight and be lazy. It's actually the perfect way to fight and be a coward because she's the only enemy you think you have a chance to beat. If you had to go into the world and actually interact with somebody who actually knew something, so as you're perceiving it, well, at least I can take her. And I don't mean this physically. I mean this in terms of your conversations and who is being right. And of course, these are just tips of the iceberg of conflict. And if any of those kinds of things are under the surface in some of your conflicts, they are potentially humbling things. They'd be humbling to have to acknowledge. And also, if you can't acknowledge your part in where some of the conflict is coming from, how are you going to be humble enough for there to be resolution to any of the conflict? So it's got to start with acknowledging you might be at least part of the problem. Maybe it is entirely your spouse. Probably not. So some resolution tips, some conflict tips, and then looking underneath the surface, some resolution tips. Because opportunities for conflict really are going to happen, maybe like right now, before the session is done. Or they are offered the bigger piece of dessert in between sessions, and they don't offer to trade. Honey, I have communicated my expectation before. You know I like the bigger piece of dessert. It's more manly to have the bigger piece. So, simple things, big things. There is always going to be some sin looking to get out, looking for an opportunity to leak out or explode. So what can you do? What must you do? Well, let's start with some things that you can do. You can try. You can try a variety of things. As a relationally debilitated, I tried to get my wife to give me a whole bunch of adjectives to describe some of what my relational problems were. It's like playing that pyramid game. Relationally debilitated, relationally retarded, relationally like slow, relationally not having an idea, like all those kinds of things. I was actually really provoked in a good way by the book I mentioned at the very beginning called Fighting for Your Marriage. It's written by three different authors. It does not claim to be a Christian book. Your mileage may vary, but it gave me some things to think about I had never even considered before. And, of course, some of the things that I might even mention under you can try or could try these things, they might sound silly. But look, if you're stuck in some kind of conflict you can't get out of, then clearly what you have been doing isn't working, so why not try something else? Like, why not at least try? So, like, you could agree to give one person in a heated discussion, you could agree to give one person the floor. This is an illustration that I learned, and we don't necessarily have to practice this, but it's a good idea that I got from Fighting for Your Marriage. So, like, by floor, a piece of carpet or wood or linoleum, probably granite is bad because it'd be heavy to hold on to, or sharp around the edges, depending on the piece that you had. So, I guess they sometimes make magnets that can go on the fridge that look like the floor, a piece of floor that can be used. So the person who has the floor, like actually literally who has the floor, they get to talk. And that person who has the floor gets to talk and share his or her concerns, his or her hurts, and the one that does not have the floor has to listen because they don't have the floor. And they can ask clarifying questions. They can repeat back maybe what they heard to make sure that everybody agrees on what was being said, what the matter was before they move on, and then the floor goes to the other person. And potentially, by needing to pay attention to the fact that you don't have the floor, you're not just, as a lawyer, sort of mentally scribbling out all of your comebacks. Think about not just having a bunch of comebacks. Floor goes to the person. Process is repeated. You could try that if you are in a especially combative situation. Maybe you need to try that for just 10 minutes. Set a timer. And then don't pick the deepest, darkest 30-year-old issue that you have. Choose something that both of you are bugged by, that you know is a source of conflict, and see if you can make some progress just in that short little piece of time. You can schedule a time and place to talk. Make a date. Probably not best while you're on a date. Definitely don't like plan some kind of romantic date and then after the appetizer is finished say, I've been meaning to talk to you. Because next time when they say, I don't actually want to go out tonight. Well, why not? I'm trying to be romantic and take you on a date. It's not winsome. Don't do it late at night when both of you are exhausted. Don't do it with the TV on. Dave, it was good. Mo and I looked at each other when Dave was given the illustration about how couples are distanced by the TV. And I think they only have 4 or 5 TVs in their bedroom. And that's just because they're so tight. Doesn't matter if you got the TV for some people. So don't try to resolve some conflict that you're having with 10 minutes to go at dinner when you've got to rush out the door to take a kid to some sports practice. If you get good at resolution, at resolving things, then go ahead and deal with it whenever. That's fine. But this is sort of presuming that you're not good at it. So sometimes if your car needs a transmission replacement, it's going to require a day in the shop. Go on a walk together. Bring home pizza or some kind of dinner, takeout for dinner so that she doesn't have to cook that night. Don't try to resolve conflict while you are naked in bed getting ready for sex. That's a bad place. Don't, at that point, demand sex based on 1 Corinthians 7, even though you're livid at your spouse. The communion and intimacy you're supposed to be sharing is going to be ruined. You're going to be working against what the sexual relationship is supposed to enable. You could read a book together or listen to a sermon together. I understand that you probably don't want to read a big book about dealing with conflict, either because who wants to read when they're mad? Or if you're not mad, who cares about reading about conflict? But some of that is good. So I highly recommend Fighting for Your Marriage. This is a big book. I mentioned it a couple times. Again, worth taking in chunks. There was a two-part sermon series that Doug Wilson did called Decluttering Your Marriage. He turned it into a book, but you could actually just read the sermon notes or listen to the audio, Decluttering Your Marriage. This book has nothing to do with family. I wish it did, actually. Jim mentioned it. Did you mention? But you need to take extreme ownership of your money. Jonathan could have mentioned that. As a steward, because it's not your money. But you take extreme ownership of how it's not your money, because it's God's. Yeah. By Jocko. This happened in my house. She knew I was reading this book. She hasn't read a word of the book. And we're talking about some money stuff, and she said to me, "Well, what do you think Jocko would say?" And that is both the worst and funny. Jocko! There's a great book, and this is probably the best book cover ever of any book ever printed at any time. I don't agree with a number of the things that he says, but it's still a fantastic book to think through. How to Be Free from Bitterness. There are some dozen, it's not the book, so it doesn't have that picture, but Jim gave Mo 10 or 12 copies to bring back. They're right here. You can come up and take one. They're no charge. It is the book, just in a different magazine format. And one of the things he just keeps harping on, is if you are still angry, then you keep praying and repenting and don't get up until you're not angry anymore. It's not okay. So deal with it and then get up and get going. So read a book together. Listen to some sermons together. Get outside help. And you should get outside help if there's no progress, if things just escalate, if there's threats, if there is a debilitating withdrawal. The other person is just avoiding in every way. You can schedule regular checkups. You can look for positive things to praise your spouse about. Serve them in little ways. Maybe some of those things are like the preventative medicine, as Jonathan said, preventing rather than fixing. But that said, some of the preventative work that we do could be putting some dirt into the ruts so that the next time the wheel goes over that part of the road, it doesn't go down as deep. So the preventative is meaningful. Now, those are all the kinds of things that are the tip of the iceberg just for what you can do. I do want to give you two things that you must do, that are musts, that are not optional. Two tips, and I'm going to try to show a little bit of the iceberg underneath the surface of those tips as well. Number one, stop being angry. Conflict between two people happens because one or both of them are angry. Now, anger has different faces and volume levels. Anger has mothers, such as bitterness and impatience and selfishness. Anger's father is always pride. Pride sleeps around with other sins and gives birth to anger. But you really have to decide that anger is not allowed in you anymore. And anger is not allowed in you no matter what your spouse does. This is not anger is, you know, stop being angry, you. This is, I'm going to stop being angry at you, period. So here is your conflict resolution tip. Tolerate anger as much as God does, which is to say you can't, because the Father killed his Son to pay for every time you have ever been angry. His Son was crucified for sake of all our anger. God does not have tolerance for selfish anger. You are going to have problems to deal with. You are going to have difficult decisions to make. Some of your preferences will be ignored. You will have annoyances that need to be absorbed. Just don't get angry. Laugh. Like, try that. Or hug. Or sing a song together. Instead of fighting one another, think about fighting it together. You must decide that anger is not acceptable. Paul said to kill sin and then to, he said, put to death what is earthly in you in Colossians chapter 3. And then he said to put it off. Colossians chapter 3, verse 8. But now you must put them all away or put them off. Anger, wrath, malice, slander, and obscene talk from your mouth. So if you start to put on the dirty shirt of anger, put it down. Keep putting it down. It's got the tractor beam pulling up, you know. The dirty shirt of anger is like Thor's hammer to your hand. And you've got to have the anger shirt to wear. Put it down. Put it off. You don't wear that shirt anymore. It doesn't belong on you. It's not Christian. You don't do it. If you get mad, confess it. Turn away from it. Don't justify it. Then put on kindness and gentleness. Put on Christ. Bear with one another. Forgive one another. Put on love, which binds everything in harmony together. Colossians 3, 12 through 15. Put on then as God's chosen ones, holy and beloved, compassionate hearts. Like, in terms of conflict resolution, if all you did was just put on a compassionate heart. I'm wearing this shirt. Throw your stuff at me. I've got my compassionate heart shirt on. Compassionate hearts, kindness, humility, meekness, and patience, bearing with one another. And if one has a complaint against another, forgiving each other. As the Lord has forgiven you, so you also must forgive. And above all these things, put on love, which binds everything together in perfect harmony. And let the peace of Christ rule in your hearts, to which indeed you were called in one body, and be thankful. This is for Christians. This is for a church body. Absolutely. Are you a Christian? Then it's not optional for you to practice it towards the other Christian, the one that's living in your house. He or she is a part of the church body, so treat them like you're supposed to treat all the members of the church body. And do you remember what paragraph it is that comes right after this instruction? It is the paragraph that starts talking about household responsibilities, and the very first household responsibility are for wives and husbands. If Christians treated each other like Christians, and Christian spouses treated one another like Christian spouses, we wouldn't be angry. So put on the kindness of Christ. Be self-controlled. You know who vents their emotions? Fools. But like says God. I didn't just make that up. Fools vent their little irritations. Proverbs 14, verse 29. Whoever is slow to anger has great understanding, but he who has a hasty temper exalts folly. Over your house, it says, who is king? Wisdom or foolishness? So, guys in particular, who's king of your house? Wisdom or fool? The angry person says, I want fool to reign in this house. Stop acting like you have to. Proverbs 16, verse 32, whoever is slow to anger is better than the mighty, and he who rules his spirit than he who takes a city. I listened to a sermon a couple times just this past week. I've listened to it. I actually mentioned it in last year's seminar talk that I gave called Themes in Proverbs number 15. Very sexy title. Themes in Proverbs 15. Self-control. I listened to it again a couple times this week, and I am like, I am ashamed at how angry and not self-controlled I have been. I can't recommend listening to that message more. I got links in my notes that I'll put online once some of the other things are ready. Self-control carries over everywhere. Some of us default to anger. We've established patterns of anger. We have taught the other person how to be nervous around us. We've taught them to expect a fight, and they come with defensive guards up. We've taught them to try to guess when and how hot we'll be. We've shown our spouse how to handle it when we don't like something. I don't like something, I get mad about it. It's funny how then when you see your spouse react to something that they don't like and they get mad about it. So you get mad at your wife because she's mad at you. She ought to say at this point, well, if it's so easy to not be mad, then why don't you show me how to do it? I have had that said to me, which really made me more mad. I can't, I'm not. If it's so easy, just go ahead and do it. Show me how. You're standing in the rain, yelling at her for holding a broken umbrella while you're standing under a broken gutter. It's gushing down on you, and you're mad yelling at her because you think she's doing it wrong. Walk in the Spirit. Dave mentioned Galatians 5. The works of the flesh include enmity, strife, and fits of anger. You need to hate anger. You need to hate what anger leaves in its wake. You need to kill anger in every possible place it could grow. You can't get angry at traffic. You can't get angry at trials. You can't get angry at your kids. So otherwise, you're just going to let it come out at your spouse. You're not going to be able to hold on to it if you just let it grow. Trying to resolve conflict when you're angry is like trying to sculpt an ice cube with a bulldozer. You're not going to do it. Walk in the Spirit. Here is another helpful image to consider. Here's the question. Should I ever be angry at my spouse? Jocko says no. Good. Anger is the one thing you're not allowed to get after. You're supposed to get after it not being angry. I was thinking about trying to make a flow chart. If this happens, can you be angry? No. If this happens, can you be angry? No. And tried to provide a whole series of no's, but I let Jocko and his butt chin help us. No. Maybe you are thinking to yourself, I'm not angry. Okay, well, being apathetic about the state of your marriage is not actually that much better, and avoiding the other person is not that much better, or just being annoyed at them is not that much better, and anger is kind of next on the scale, and then there's aggression or abuse, and none of those are godly, so stop being angry. And it doesn't really matter what you say about it, it is how you treat the other person that demonstrates what you really want. And some of us want to be angry. We can't control what we want, so we get to let everybody else know that it's not okay that we don't get what we want. So stop it. The second tip of things you must do is desire God's blessing on your marriage. I said that at the beginning, that we want more than just fighting less. We want more than just resolving conflict quicker. Those are good. Those are good steps. They're still not the ultimate goal. We're not making any cultural people jealous by our ability to nicely pass a carpet magnet back and forth while we're resolving our conflict. The Jews are jealous. Have they seen our magnets? Wow, they're going to want those. Come to Jesus because of our magnets. The chief end, I was just playing around with this. So if you are one of those doctrine idolatry people, then you can smash my idol later. So I was playing around with this. The chief end of marriage is to glorify God by reflecting him and enjoying the glad intimacy of your relationship. And he loves to give that sort of blessing because that's what he made it for. And so do we want that? Well, we want somebody who makes dinner and finally folds our socks the right way and finds them wherever it is we may have left them around the house in the meantime. Want blessing. And I think that this idea reminds us that a good marriage is beyond our control. in one way. It's a gift of God. We're supposed to depend on Him. God blesses our obedience, and He blesses humility and blesses those who keep short accounts with one another. That's part of the obedience piece. So, like, if you find that that is not what you really want, then pray and ask for help. God, change or deepen my desires to match your desires. God has been working to make great marriages for some 6,000 years. If you're not confessing your sin to your spouse, He's not going to bless the relationship. You need to do all the things that He says. So want blessing, desire that blessing on your marriage, meditate on it, pray for it personally, like individually, as well as together, pursue it. And then when you see God's blessing on what is happening, give Him thanks. And then say, God, give us more. He can, by grace, fix hearts and relationships and sort out years of sinful patterns and hurtful consequences. It may not be easy, and it's not something that gets changed overnight. But we're not talking about immediate comfort. We're talking about God's blessing. That's worth pursuing, even if it's hard. God thinks marriage is glorious. It is not better to be alone and be right. Deal with your conflict in such a way that makes Jews say that based on the Romans 11 passage and the world jealous. That's part of a blessed life, and then your marriage will be and bring blessing to your kids, to your neighbors, whatever it is. It's not complicated. There are no conditions limiting your responsibility to God's commands. Things you can try, and some things that you must do. Stop being angry and desire His blessing on your marriage. And that will be a blessing to the world. Father, thanks for our time to think about these things. Thanks for Your Spirit, which keeps breaking down our pride and not letting us be satisfied with what we thought we wanted. Thanks for cleaning up our messes because of the work of Your Son. Our hope is in Him. And I pray this in His name. Amen.